dear George. Happy birthday, dear George. Happy birthday, dear George Washington. Happy non-birthday to you. Look what they've done to your birthday, George. They're celebrating it on the 18th of February now, when everybody knows you were born on February 22nd. Thank you, George, for your George Orwell ploy tonight. Oh, yeah, this is pure George Orwell. You know, we can move dates around now anytime. In fact, I expect a government fiat one day to say, from now on, we refuse to call February February because everybody hates February because it's cold. From now on, February will be called June. And you will enjoy spring weather, all what used to be called February, and all of you can have your vacation now, the first week of June, and you won't have any problems at all. It'll be great. Happy birthday. No, I refuse to celebrate George Washington's birthday on the 18th. I'm sorry. Now, that's what this is, right? Okay. George Washington, I repeat, government, was born on the 22nd of February, and it's very well documented. It's not apocryphal. So I am not going to celebrate George Washington's birthday today. No way. Nope. You know, look, one thing that George Washington is famous for, what? Honesty. Forthrightness. And the last thing that George Washington would have conceded is that he was born on the 18th of February. He just says, look, fellas, I'm sorry. I know you want to do it because it gives everybody a long weekend in spite of the fact that he can't get no gas and can't do nothing anyway, and it's going to be rainy and cruddy anyway, so I'm just not going to go along with that, fellas. And then he put his wooden teeth back in. And by the way, can't you imagine George Washington with his wooden teeth doing a denture commercial for TV? Happy birthday, poor George. Oh, and you know, speaking of veracity, I am delighted to notice a little thing that I'm delighted to notice. I'm delighted to notice that a couple of days ago, it took 8 days for a registered letter to be sent from the court out in California to, you know, they were going to subpoena the president. Did you read about that? It took 8 days. They lost it in the mail for a while. And it kind of makes you feel like this is a true democracy. Do you realize that, Jim? This is a true democracy in that they even lose the president's subpoena in the mail, just like they lose everything else that I get in the mail except the bills. I have never I've never known those crumbs to those bills arrive even ahead of time. They arrive before they're mailed. Fantastic. It's only the checks that get lost. You know, the non-existent checks. And by the way, don't go away, Jim. I'm just saying that I noticed that the newest stamp, and I like to salute cultural developments in our time, not for our time. I know damn well our time doesn't care about this, but I know 100 years from now they're going to be listening to this tape, and they're going to say that's the way it really was, as opposed to the way the New York Times says it was. This is the way it really was. And New York Times, take note. I have just received a letter today with the newest postage stamp issued by our post office department, which even loses the president's subpoena in the mail. It's a postage stamp that shows a guy sorting letters. Did you see that? Yeah, it's a salute. The post office salutes itself. Now, this is what I call true ego. And it shows a guy throwing mail into various, you know, buckets of mail there. And I trust he was throwing a few bits of mail into the wrong bucket there, right on the stamp there, which would give us a little touch of realism, which we don't normally expect, right? Okay, so I'd like to salute the post office department, which is now saluting itself, and God knows why, I don't know. Oh, thank you, Jim. You are very brave. Now, what I am going to do, though, tonight... hey, listen, before I go any further, I saw a fantastic thing happen the other day, and I guess basically we're all secretly sadists. We like to see other people suffer, right? We don't admit it, though. Oh, no. What do you think television is? You sit there hour after hour, guys are getting shot. Hour after hour, they're carrying the bodies off, you know, with the red light going, woo, woo, woo. An hour after hour, the police surgeon is looking down at this inert form. And people are sitting there digging it, and they're eating their Frito-Lays and drinking their Diet Pepsi and their beer while they're watching and stuff. And they try to pretend they don't like to see other people suffer. That's what television's about. I mean, if you took all suffering off of TV, what would we be left with? Even the commercial show Suffering shows a girl suffering from the frizzies, you know? You know what the frizzies are, don't you? That's a terrible thing that's hit all the models in New York. You got to use special stuff to do justice to the frizzies. And if you took all suffering off of television, what would you be left with? Test pattern. take all suffering away. That would kill the news right away. No news. I mean, that's what news is about. And once in a while, Joel Siegel would come on and salute the American Salami Institute or something like that. The various things of that type. But, you take away from suffering, you know, you got nothing left, really. I'm going to tell you what I saw the other day. You like a story of inhuman suffering? You like that? Laced with a curious kind of social commentary, right? You like that? It gives it the meaning and depth. I mean, you don't want to just see a guy slip on a banana peel and land on the back of his head. Oh, well, that would make you laugh. I mean, if it's done right, you know. George, look at him. He did four cartwheels in the air. Look at that. Oh, there he goes. You don't want to really admit that you laugh at people. Like, now, if you can have it be, let's say, a picket member carrying a sign for an organization which you don't like, and then he falls on a banana peeling, that gives it a kind of political connotation, right? Everything has to have a political connotation today. If you're going to have a kidnapping, you don't just hold up and kidnap somebody. You got to have a political thing going with it. Or at least you got to pretend it is. A strike against the establishment. But nevertheless, I was at a luncheon the other day. It's a very elegant East Side restaurant. Now, for those of you who don't know much about the New York way of life, the mores of the local natives, there are certain restaurants all throughout the East Side that are built entirely on the expense account structure. Cash never changes hands in these restaurants. Cash has become kind of unclean in many of these places, and you can hear nothing but the rattle of credit cards. The sound of expense. Yeah, in fact, I know one place that's they call it the padding bar, and you ask them what the padding bar is about. I figured it was an English thing, you know, Paddington Station and all that old English decor. And I go in there and I sit down and say, "Oh, yeah." And the guy says, "Well, what you have, mate?" And this is the bartender. He says, "What you have, mate?" And I said, "Oh, a little arp and arp." And he says, "Aye." And the next, again, it's purely English, you know, so there's a lot of that that goes on in these East Side joints. And so they used to be French. A few years ago, it was all very elegant to have guys named Rini. Well, a lot of them could just as well have been called Rini. But in fact, many were off work, you know. It's kind of distressing to see your first, you know, the head waiter when goes back to change costume in a uniform after he leaves work and goes out and he's wearing a pair of Dior high heels. You know, it's kind of depressing. But nevertheless, a little exciting, though. It adds a certain touch of gaiety to the town. But nevertheless, I go into this English-type pub. Everything's called a pub today, see? And he had the padding bar. And so I go into the padding bar, and I said to the guy, this is the kind of thing that Englishmen are good at saying, or core, or ear. They have grunts and things like, you know, they do that. You know that, don't you, Joe? Mm. So I go, and he said, "What do you have, mate?" And I said, arf and arp. And he said, "Yeah, earp." And so he pulls the harp and arf. He's got these great big knobs, see, and he pulls the thing out, and he gives me this arf and arf. And I'm looking up, just trying to make conversation. Padding bar, eh? And he says, "Yerp." And I said, "What padding?" He says, "Expense account." So I realize it's a salute to the expense account padding. And what you do is you go into this bar and pad your expense account. They had $12 drinks. And you get a $4 kickback. See, that kind of thing. So anyway, life goes on in the big city here, and it will continue to go on. So I'm in this elegant restaurant, and I'm sitting there with these guys. A waiter comes over, and he gives us the menu, and all four of us are sitting around. And one of them happened to have been the executive vice president of one of the most elegant ad agencies in the entire Western world. And these are very elegant men. You know, the kind of people that are always... it's very difficult to tell whether they're avant-garde or whether they're still voting for McKinley for president. There's a combination of both. In fact, that's an avant-garde thing today, you know. To be so old-fashioned that you've become hip and in. And so he came in there, and he was wearing his Dickensian glasses. The only guy that I've seen in years use an ear trumpet. It's very hip. This is all part of the new thing. So he's sitting over there, and he takes out this calabash pipe. Now, you know what a calabash pipe is. You know, they make them out of gourds, calabashes. No, it's a calabash pipe. It's a great big pipe, you know. And it's got a big white meerschaum top on it. Fantastic-looking pipe. And he takes out his tobacco pouch, which is made out of hand-tanned rhinoceros hide. Just beautiful, see? And they had the stamp of the British Empire on it. It's a Victoria Regina, VR, on it. And so he takes out his tobacco pipe. Listen to this, Joe. He takes out his tobacco pipe, see? And certain guys who are big top executives have learned to everything they perform, they do it with meaning. So if you're with a top executive and he's about to take off his glasses, here's the way it's done, see? You're sitting in front of his desk. And you come in, and you're about to ask him for a raise. See, you say, "Excuse me, Mr. Bullard, but it's been 25 years, and I'm getting $23 a week, and the boys are starting to laugh at me down at the Chock Full of Nuts because, the kids that clean up the dishes are getting more money than I get in one day. They get more money than I get in a week, Mr. Bullard." And at that point, Mr. Bullard goes, "Well." This is very sudden, Snively. I wish you'd given us a little warning before you laid this bomb on us, Snively. We could have called the employment agency and made some arrangements for a replacement. You're going to leave us awful short, you know. Certainly very inconsiderate. After all, we've taken care of you for 27 years now. And at that point, he takes his left hand and very carefully removes his glasses and starts to polish them. This is known as a pregnant pause. Rack. And Snively, of course, is trying to get his brain in focus, but what he's really watching is the glasses. See, it's like what magicians always do this. They take your mind off of what you come in for, right? It's all hocus pocus. Which reminds me, this is WOR in New York. Oh, hi, George, what that kid. Let's hit him with a commercial while they're still quivering, Joe.
Yes, let's have some bugles. Play them big.
Your AMC dealer's got the all-new mid-sized car that economizes on everything but comfort. That car, the roomy 74 Matador.
Bugles, let's go.
And another important advantage. Our 74 Matador comes with an economical six-cylinder engine as standard equipment. And consider this. Matador is the only new mid-sized car backed by all the benefits of the exclusive AMC Fire Protection Plan. Which means that under normal usage and accepting
tires, if anything AMC did goes wrong with your new 74 Matador in the first 12 months or 12,000 miles, we'll fix or replace it free.
All right, let's go, boys.
Come in today. Meet the unbeatable combination. 74 Matador backed by the AMC Buyer Protection Plan.
Yeah, go see your AMC dealer. You get a good deal more. Yeah, I did that well.
Hello, friends. This is Lorelei. I mean, Carol. Carol Channing? Well, what I really mean is I am Lorelei. That is, Lorelei's my big new Broadway musical show at the Palace Theater, and just everybody who's anybody loves our show, especially the critics. You tell them, Mike.
Well, Clive Barnes of the New York Times says Carol Channing is a woman I unashamedly adore, and Martin Godfrey Women's Wear says Lorelei is the first genuinely professional musical of the season.
Yes, as I said, just everybody loves our show, so come and see us at the Palace Theater. And for more information, call me. That's Carol at the Palace Theater, Plaza 7, 2626. Just ask for Carol.
I'm Richard A. Givens, Regional Director of the Federal Trade Commission. Investigations have shown that many people sued for non-payment of installment bills didn't know the suit. There's a new law in New York State that gives judges in civil courts the right to throw out cases if there are abuses by the creditors. If you were cheated or didn't know of the suit against you and had to pay anyway, notify the FTC at 26 Federal Plaza, New York, 10007.
Very good. Indeed. Anyway, to make the long story short, I'm sitting there with these elegant guys, see? Now, listen carefully to this, Lee. I want you to hear this story. We're sitting there at this elegant restaurant, and I didn't realize that I was about to see one of the most heinous, that's a good word, heinous, that means rotten, Joe, one of the most heinous practical jokes I've ever seen in my life, pulled on a man of great distinction. Now, you know, a joke becomes even funnier if it's done to a person who has elegance about it. I mean, you know the old story of a kid throwing snowballs at a guy's hat. If a guy's wearing a Mets hat, that's not funny. But if he's wearing a high silk hat and he's on his way to the opera, that has a little added humor to it. So anyway, this guy takes out his calabash pipe. And like many top executives, he's given to giving long, involved dissertations.
Well, you know, I've been giving a lot of thought to this problem of motivational research. And I feel that in certain instances, take, for example, the present situation that we are attempting to discuss here today at this meeting, the motivational research, which we have done, Brack, and at that point, to emphasize this point, he takes his calabash pipe and he dips his calabash pipe
into his rhinoceros skin tobacco pouch. And of course, it's always polite then, if you are sitting with a guy like that, to ask him what kind of pipe tobacco he's smoking. This is kind of a little thing among pipe tobacco types, you know. And so one of the little guys, I think his name was C.L. Maggot, one of the little guys who worked for the same agency, immediately spoke. Well, excuse me, Chief. I just want to know what's the tobacco you're using in the pipe there, Chief? Chief, you know, glad you asked, Maggot. It's a Belgian tobacco that I have shipped in from Liège. Little tobacconist there off the Rue Saint Paris. I found one day, and he ships it in to me fresh every 2 weeks by helicopter. And, yes, it's a mixture number 422, made especially for me, Brack.
And, of course, everyone's impressed. He has his own tobacconist in Liège, Belgium. That's really elegant, isn't it? You agree, Joe? I mean, that's like sitting there in a bar, you know, and you're drinking a whiskey, and the guy says, what are you drinking? He says, oh, well, I have my own little
whiskey maker in the hills of Kentucky, and he brews this for me especially, and they fly it in by DC-3. I'll drink nothing else. Oh, yes, yes, Caleb certainly turns out a nice brew. That would impress people, wouldn't it? Everybody else is sitting around drinking Jack Daniels and I.W. Harper, and you've got your own little whiskey maker with his own little still in the hills of Kentucky. Wouldn't that be kind of elegant? Okay, now you understand. See, when I put it in terms of whiskey, you being a good Connecticut whiskey drinker, understand. Now, that's the equivalent of what this guy's laying on us, see? He said, Brock. He said, it's a little mixture that I have made up in Liège in Belgium. Of course, I was in Belgium here 2 years ago, and I ran into this wonderful little tobacconist there named Pierre. And we spent the whole afternoon testing out various mixtures. He gets this rare Latakia from Algeria, and he mixes it up for me and flies it in by
autogyro every 2 weeks, and it's just wonderful. Of course, it's just my own particular taste. Brack. And he stuffs it down, and brack, 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 brack. Now, there's a certain type of guy who is such a snob that he wouldn't light his pipe with a, you know, take a folding matches out, you know, and light the pipe like that, you know, like ordinary people, or a Zippo lighter with a naked girl painted on the side, you know, that kind of stuff. I'll never forget that one day I was lighting this chick, this girl I was out with one time. It was a very elegant restaurant. And she smoked these hand-rolled Egyptian cigarettes. And she was that type, you know. And she had elegant perfumes and stuff. And so she leans forward for me to light her cigarette. And being a gentleman, I reaches in my pocket. Oh, what the hell am I going to do now, see? And I'm not a smoker type, so I'm looking in there. And I had a book of folding matches, which I had picked up somewhere along the line. You know, I carried and I pick it out, and I take this book of folding matches, and I hold it up like this, and I'm lighting it, and I saw her eyes sort of bulge out like that for a second while I'm lighting. And right on the outside of my folding matches, it says, Fight VD. Yes, and you know, I it was kind of embarrassing to come up there just at that moment. It had a great big thing. It says, Fight VD. Well, so this gentleman that was far more elegant than that, he reaches into his pocket and brack, brack. You could tell his suit is made by a little Italian tailor in Milan, you know, who does nothing but keep his suits being turned out there all day long. And he makes nothing but suits for this guy, so he's going to reach his brack. Well, I'm glad you asked, Maggot. It's an elegant little mixture, Maggot. And Maggot's going, he's making those little squeaky sounds of yes. Yes, 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 Chief. And he takes out of his pocket what all real pipe smokers, the elegant type, always use, a gigantic kitchen match. You understand, that's very in, see? And he reaches into his other pocket and takes out a small rock. It's a stone that he carries with him, see? And you can see where he's been scratching matches on it. Of course, we're all gassed. You know, this is a guy, real elegant. He puts the stone down there right in front of him, see? And with that, Maggot says, oh, that's very interesting, Chief. What the, where's that stone from? John, glad you ask, Maggot. This is a special match-striking stone from the coast of Nigeria, which I picked up on my safari. And I never without it, Brack. And, of course, you realize that the noxious gases which are formed by the ordinary match-striking stone are not present in this type of stone. People come from all over the world to pick up these stones, and this is one of the better ones. And we pipe smokers prefer this sort of thing. He lights this match. There's a giant flame. So it goes up like that. And for one brief instant, his face is gone. You can't see it. There's a big flame. For a minute, I thought his eyebrows were on fire. Or maybe, you know, his sideburns. He had these giant ad agency sideburns. I thought for a minute there, you know, we're going to have to call for Adam 12 or something. So, anyway, he's going... Here's the way he lights his pipe. It goes... You know, you've seen him do it. Sounds like a giant roto-rooter sump pump going into high gear. See... And there's a giant cloud. It is blue smoke. See, and he's blowing. And from tables around us, you know, people are watching this ritual. Very elegant ritual. And he settles back, and you can see this glowing flames coming out of the top of his pipe. And he blows the smoke all around us. Well, I'm sitting on the opposite side of the table, and I get this great black cloud of smoke just sort of envelops me and moves on, moving down towards Madison Avenue somewhere. And I couldn't help it. See, I just... Brack. At least I knew it was a very expensive cough I was having. So you don't really say things like, what the hell is that? You're burning in that thing, for God's sakes, Clifford. You know, it smelled like an Irish peat bog. An Irish peat bog after the natives have been tromping on wine in their bare feet. Wait a minute, I'm mixing metaphors there, right? The Irish natives don't tromp on wine in their bare feet in a peat bog, do they? I kind of like the picture if they did, but Nevertheless, there, that's enough for you, Breslin. Sit down. So, he's smoking his pipe, and now he's talking to us like this with a pipe clamped between his lips. You know, it's a certain kind of man who talks with his pipe clamped in his teeth, like C. Aubrey Smith. Remember from him? You could just see him. He's conquering the Indian, beating down a native. Brackley, you have the figures over there. My latest motivational research on a catch-up account. I'd like to see those figures right now. You can bring them out. And I'd like to analyze them here. Brackley
takes another big suck at it. Pipe tobacco, and you can hear the sump pump really working. Another big blast of black smoke envelops all of us.
Well, I could tell there was something vaguely wrong. Just vaguely.
A curious look crossed his face. You know, the human face is a very, very highly communicative instrument. You know that. Several changes of expression will communicate an entire idea to people. It's a language, the language of the face. You ever thought about that, Joe? That's right. I mean, all you got to do, you stand back there, you know, and you just look at somebody with a certain look on your face. You haven't said a thing, and he's ready to kill you. Right? You're just saying something with your face, the way you're arranging the muscles around your nose. That's right. A very, very subtle language, the face. Very, very. And at this point, we noticed slight confusion, vague irritation, and the look of a man about to fire somebody. All went over his face in a brief instant. At that point, Maggot began to make squeaking sounds. Excuse me, Chief. Waiter. He figured that the boss was mad because the waiter hadn't come to bring him his elk. By the way, this is the kind of man, I have to tell you another thing this man did. I'll never forget this moment. When the waiter came over in this elegant English restaurant, and he leaned over the head of the agency and says, the regular, sir? And he says, of course. And at that point, the waiter scurries away and comes back with a martini. And he puts it down in front of the chief, just beautifully chilled and cooled. You can see it there. And the waiter waited for a second, see, while the chief reached down to pick up the martini and goes, he sips.
Very good, Clarence. Very good.
His martini was approved. And later on, I couldn't help but ask. I said, gee, that was very interesting, chief. Very interesting how the waiter came over. What is your regular? What is your regular?
Well, of course, I have my own martini glass here. They keep my glass on chilled. I like it chilled at exactly 56 degrees. And I have my own glass. They keep my own gin here. Yes, of course. It's a gin that's sent in to me every 2 weeks from Calcutta. That's a Calcutta gin. Very good. And, of course, my vermouth, we don't really use vermouth in my martinis. I am not the vermouth man. The vermouth is merely kept in the same cooler with my martini. By just the proper aroma.
My God, there's a man who is so elegant that at his restaurant he has his own martini glass. Try that one, Joe, at your local bar. And they keep it in a special little cooler for him only, 56 degrees, with his own gin. Yes, and it's Calcutta gin, which is very rare gin and probably the worst gin ever made in the world, but it's nevertheless from Calcutta. It ain't from Teaneck. And so we're sitting there very impressed, and he's got this funny look on his face, and he goes, clap, takes another suck on a pipe, and the pipe is getting blacker and blacker as time goes on. The smoke now is almost impenetrable. And the four of us are sitting there waving the smoke around, trying to talk to each other. And at this point, I noticed people in surrounding tables are beginning to cough and hack.
And one guy got up and came back wearing a gas mask and sat down. You know, have you ever seen a guy drink onion soup through a gas mask? It was exciting. So this went on for about 20 minutes, and finally he decides he's through with his pipe. And he takes it, and he holds it upside down and takes the same little Nigerian rock and begins to tap on it in the following fashion. He's tapping it, and he's snorting over the sheet.
I'll be damned. I thought there was something wrong.
And he reaches down into his pipe and pulls out a long, charred, partially burned rubber band. He has been smoking a rubber band in his pipe. Now, I don't know whether you have ever smelled burning rubber in your time, Tony. You have. So have you ever smoked rubber? That must be one hell of a smoke.
He's good, okay, stand it. Rubber black.
And all of us are sitting there. Somebody has put a rubber band in his cheap $12,000 handmade Turkish pipe. And he takes out his pipe tobacco pouch, takes it out, and dumps it out on the table.
I'll be damned. Maggot, we're going back to the office, and we're going to start an investigation.
And I said, what happened, Chief?
Somebody has chopped rubber bands in my tobacco. Somebody has gotten to the humidor back in the office and put rubber bands in my tobacco.
And at that, he jumped up and leaped and roared out, followed by Maggot, his faithful toady. And I thought to myself, what a fantastic dance. Somebody has gotten into the chief humidor and chopped rubber bands into his elegant Belgian tobacco. How's that for a rotten practical joke? But so beautiful, then he sat there. He must have been smoking rubber bands for 3 days. Without knowing it. And I just sat back there and I said, you know. And I never know every question. Did you give me a little of that raunchy type music that you introduced, man? Deep-seated. Yeah. And so tonight is part of our special public service broadcasting on the feature from Film Radio Station.
Well, here's your Marisa.
check that, Joe. Joe, reset that for a second. How much time do you have? Right, that's good enough. Okay, now listen. I want to do something here tonight, just reset that, Joe. And I'm going to use this. That music in this. Hold on. I am going to do something for you tonight. Somebody wrote me a note and said, Shepard, you're the top living expert today on the poems of Robert Service. And I said, yes, of course. He said, now you've done the shooting of Dan McGrew and you've done the cremation of Sam McGee. He said, I'd like to hear more of this poetry of Robert Service. Stuff you don't ordinarily hear. I said, yes, that's a good point. And I'm going to read you something out of Robert Shirley that I know you never heard before. I know it. So sneak in a little of that raunchy music, Joe, and you are now going to hear the ballad of Salvation Bill. Oh, yes. Twas as in the bleary middle of the hard-boiled Arctic night, I was lonesome as a loon. So if you can imagine my emotions of amazement and delight when I bumped into that missionary man. He was lying lost and dying in the moon's unholy leer and frozen from his toes to his fingertips. The famished wolf pack ringed round him, but he didn't seem to see as he pressed his ice-bound Bible to his lips. At the very minute of my trap line with the cabin miles away, and every step was like a stab of pain, but I packed him like a baby, and I nursed him night and day, till I got him back to health and strength again. So there we were, united in the shadow of the pole. And he might have proved a priceless little pard if he hadn't got to worrying about my blessed soul and quoting the Bible by the yard. Quoting the Bible by the yard. Now there I was, a husky guy whose God was nicotine, with a coffin nail, a fixture in my mug. I rolled them in the pages of a pulpwood magazine and hacked them with my jackknife from the plug. For all to know the thrust and the glow that good tobacco means. If you want to know this, just live among the everlasting ice. So judge my horror when I found my stock of magazines was chewed into a chowder by the mice. Now I use those magazines to roll my cigarettes with. And the mice ate them up. A woeful week went by. And not a single cigarette I had. Me that could smoke my 40 in a day. By the way, this is a poem about cigarette smoking. If you want to really hear something, he says, a woeful week went by. And not a single cigarette had I. Me that could smoke 40 in a day. I tried. I swore. I strode the floor. I felt I'd go mad. And that gospel plugger watched me in dismay. My brow was wet. My teeth were set. My nerves were racked and raw. And yet that preacher couldn't understand. So with despair, I wrestled there. And suddenly I saw out the vodka he was holding in his hand. Then something snapped inside my brain, and with an evil start, the wolf man in me woke to rabid rage. I saved your lousy life, I said. So show, just what? Show me you've got a heart, and tear me out one solitary page out of the Bible so I can throw it to the rest. He shrank and shriveled at my words. His face went pure white. Was as if I'd handed him a blow. And then he seemed to swell and grow to heaven's height. And in a voice that rang, he answered, no! I grabbed my loaded rifle and I jammed it in his chest. Come on, you shrimp, get in that book, says I. Well, sir, he was a parson. But he stacked up with the best, and for grit, I got the handle to that guy. If I should let you desecrate this holy word, he said, my soul would be eternally accursed.
So go on, Bill. I'm ready. You can pump me full of lead and take it. But you've got to kill me first. Well, I'm no foul assassin, although I'm full of sinful ways, and I knew right there that the fellow had me beat, for I felt a yellow mongrel in the glory of his God-ridden gaze, and I flung my foolish firearm at his feet, and then wearily I turned away and dropped upon my bunk, and there I lay and blubbered like a kid. Forgive me, pard, I said at last, for acting like a skunk. Forgive me for acting like a skunk. But hide the blasted rifle, hide it, or I'm going to kill you. Which he did. And he also hit his Bible, which was maybe just as well, for the sight of all that paper gave me pain. And there were tens of moments when I felt I'd go to hell to have one single cigarette again. So I lay day after day and brooded dark and deep until one night I thought I'd end it all. Then, rest. I roused the preacher, where he stretched pretending sleep, with his map of horror turned towards the wall. See here, my pious pal, I said, I've stood this long enough. Behold, I have mixed some strychnine in a cup, enough to kill a dozen men, and believe me, it's no bluff. Now watch me, I'm going to drink it up. You've seen me drinking by despair through bitter days and nights, and now you're going to see me squirming as I die. You're not to blame. You've played the game according to your lights. But I ask you, how would Christ have played it? Well, goodbye. This is the end. With that, I raised the deadly drink and laid it to my lips. But he was on me with a tiger bound, and as we rocked and locked and reeled and rocked with wild and wicked grips, the poison went crashing to the ground. Don't do it, Bill! He shrieked. Maybe I acted wrong. Here's my Bible. Use it as you will, but promise me you'll read a little as you go along. Promise me that you'll read a little as you go along. You do? Then take it, brother. Take it and smoke your fill. Smoke your fill. And so I did. I smoked. And I smoked from Genesis to Job. And as I smoked, I read each blessed word, while on the shadow of his bunk I heard him sigh and sob. And then the most peculiar thing occurred. I got to reading more and more, and smoking less and less, until just about the day his heart was broke, I said, here, take it back. Lad, I've had enough, I guess. Your paper makes an awful rotten smoke. Smokes real bad. And then and there, with plea and prayer, he wrestled for my soul in my little cabin, and I was racked and ravaged by regrets. But God was good, for lo, next day, there came the mounted police patrol with paper for 1,000 cigarettes. So now I'm called Salvation Bill. I teach the living law, and I ballyhoo the Bible with the rest. I go around and I thump that Bible with the best of them. And if a guy won't listen, I sock him in the jaw. And I preach the Bible, I preach the gospel, sitting right there on his chest. And he'd better listen. Now that's how one man got religion. That's the ballad of Salvation Bill. That's one of the funniest poems I've ever read about cigarette smoking. I like that line, I smoked from Genesis through Job. Yeah. Well, now that's Robert Service. And this is the first show that I can recall I've ever done about smoking. You know, pipes, cigarettes, all the whole bit. The whole evil, rotten, stinking, smelly mess.
Right.
And I'll tell you this. I'm going to ask you a question. Since this is the day that we officially celebrate Washington's birthday, what did Washington smoke, if any? Was Washington a smoker? Well, now wait a minute. You're talking to a guy who knows the answer to that question. Nope. You're wrong. They did not smoke cigarettes in his time. Cigarettes were not invented until the late 19th century.
You're getting close. There you go. There you go. General George Washington was a veteran chewer of tobacco. He was a good man with a chaw. That's right. And they say that when, in fact, George Washington's actual own private spittoon, which he had in the White House, is still preserved. Washington sit there, you know, every once in a while, you just reach over and just let it go. But I just thought you ought to know that there's other ways to celebrate friends. So why don't you chew a little mayo pouch today to celebrate George's birthday? Or a little 8-hour cut plug. How about Navy plug? Navy shag, huh? Uh-huh, you like that apple plug? Apple plug, not bad at all. Yes, yes. That'll put hair where it's supposed to be, right? W.O.R. New York, you stay tuned for John Wingate.